Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by Boyle Sports. Now with same-day withdrawals to your Visa debit card.
Good evening, good evening, good evening. In fairness, he could have picked any one of many great moments for Liverpool this season for that piece of commentary. We might play some more of them a little bit later on. How are we all doing at the Aviva Stadium? We are here, of course, to celebrate a club on the cusp of a Premier League and Champions League double was the plan when we arranged this night. Unfortunately, things may well have changed. Are we all okay after last night? No? Was anybody over at Barcelona? You're from Barcelona? Good joke. Hopefully it'll improve as the night goes on. Things can only get better. What are we thinking? 3-0 down, is it over? A special Anfield night? Can we come back? Can Liverpool come back? Oof, not fully convinced. What about the Premier League? Oof, this is definitely not as we planned it. We got a brilliant night coming up. Kenny Cunningham's going to join us in a while. We're going to go through tactically what happened last night, how the season has gone so far. But first, I want to bring out a man who's a two-time Champions League winner and very much an icon of Anfield in the 90s. Please give it up for Steve McManaman. Welcome, welcome.
Where do you want me?
You grab a seat right there.
Am I on? Yes.
You are on. We are here tonight with thanks to Boyle Sports. You can download the faster than ever Boyle Sports app for exclusive price enhancements, bet builder, and cash out on the Premier League and Champions League. These people need cheering up.
I know. I heard them just then. Do you think they're going to win the league? 3-0 down.
It's a bit like different to a week ago.
It's a bit like that. I was at the game last night and I flew in and I'm with everybody. Incredibly frustrating night. I've seen Liverpool lots and lots of times, like most people have. Red Star Belgrade, Napoli, Paris Saint-Germain. Even Bayern Munich away, I thought they played the best they played last night, yet it was the worst result. So, incredibly frustrating night. And it's going to be hard, isn't it, Anfield? Because they've got
the first goal.
They've got the best number. They've got the best player on the planet, haven't they, playing for them? But
was that simply the difference last night?
I think so. Of course, Liverpool missed some good chances, which normally the lads would score, you know, on a weekly basis. And but they have got this player who is extra special. No doubt, Liverpool fans will be told in the next week or so that, you know, Barcelona lost last year 3-0 away at Roma. The year before they lost 4-0 away at Paris Saint-Germain. So there's a chance, and there is a chance. We have to stay positive, but. It's hard, isn't it? 2-0 last night, we would have thought, okay, 3-1, okay, we've still got a chance, but 3-0 is difficult. If Liverpool were winning 3-0 and went away from home, you'd expect Liverpool to score, then the opposition would have to score 5. And that's the only thing nagging in my mind. When they've got players as special as they have, it's going to be hard, but you have to keep the faith.
Well, that pep talk went well, I think it's fair to say.
All right, lads, let's get on the drink. Come on, let's drown our sorrows.
You're obviously working over there. Do you get any sense after the game of the vibe within the squad? Can you read anything into it? Is everyone just naturally devastated?
Yeah, I think so. Very frustrated, like we all are. They all felt they played well. Jürgen Klopp felt he played well. But it just got away from them, didn't it? You know, at 1-0, Liverpool are dominating the game. They got more possession. The stats were better. You know, No teams dominated Barcelona at Camp Nou like Liverpool had, certainly after about 60 minutes. Yeah, it just suddenly turns out 3-0 at the, you know, 20 minutes later. It's like 3-0 and we're all walking away dejected. So it was a strange night, to say the least.
What sort of reception do you get at the Camp Nou going on the night Liverpool are playing as a former Real Madrid player?
Yeah, it's fine.
Scored in the Champions League semi-final there?
Yeah, I have a blanket over my head. It's fine. Don't worry about it. No, they're actually not bad. It's not... Their rivalry is not as, let's say, intense as our Liverpool-Manchester United rivalry. It is when they play,
right?
But not necessarily away from the stadium. People are not dialed into madness like they are when Liverpool and Man United play.
Yeah, because you played in some pretty crazy Clásicos.
Yeah, yeah. Yes.
You played the night of the pig's head.
I played the night of the pig's head, yeah. Golf balls were on the pitch, whiskey bottles, mobile phones, anything that anybody could pick up and throw was on the pitch. I mean, it was quite a surreal experience because if anybody alludes back to the game, Luis Figo took our corners. He was the one who took our corners, and in the end, he had to stop taking them because it was too dangerous. We had all the security guards around telling the fans to stop. But the fans were like, whoa, just chucking everything. So in the end, it was like, right, Luis, you can't take them, so someone else has to take them. And even the following year, it happened again, and the game
was just...
I just said, I'm not going over there, forget that. So, yeah. Good times.
We'll talk a bit more about the match with Kenny Cunningham. I think the lads might want to check your microphone.
Yeah.
Make sure
it's
working fine. We are live here from the Aviva Stadium, the hashtag OTB Aviva, because we're live on all our social channels as well. You can watch on offtheball.com, on YouTube, on Facebook, or you can text us on News Talk on 53106. We'll chat as well about the season as a whole. And the one line, I guess, that keeps coming up when Liverpool are in a title race, Steve, is about the length of time that it is since Liverpool won the title. Can't believe it's 29 years.
Yep.
That must resonate with you
definitely
more than anybody else. You made your debut six months after Liverpool last won the league.
I made my debut in 1990, the year they last won it. And apart from people going on and on and on, it suddenly makes you feel really, really old. You know, I still feel as if, I'm okay. You know, I can still, mix it with the younger lads. But when you keep on saying 29 years ago, I go, oh, my Lord. So, yeah, you just want to get that, that number and just chuck it away, don't you? That's what it is. And because I don't know what it is with the team Liverpool, but there's a lot of, I don't know whether it's jealousy, resentment, but there's a lot of people don't want them to win the Premier League. You know, they're more than happy for Manchester City to win. They don't want Liverpool to win.
Is that not just Manchester United fans?
I think it's a lot of fans, to be very honest. A lot
Why?
Of fans who have come across.
Because all these people will be insufferable if Liverpool win the league.
I don't know. I don't think they would be insufferable, would they?
They most definitely would.
Maybe they will be insufferable. it's a long time. It's too long, isn't it? It's too long. 29 years when they dominated in the 80s and when they dominated cup competitions.
And when you made your debut and you're working your way up through the youth team and you make your debut 6 months after they win the title in 1990, are you sort of assuming once I break into this team, I'm going to be winning leagues?
Yes, because when you looked around the dressing room, they were all, they're all superstars now, of course, but they were superstars, Barnsley's and the Whelans and the Nichols. And of course, my manager was Dalgleish. It was like this, this non-stop train that just kept on rolling along and win this and carry on and win again and carry on. You did never think that, these players are getting into their 30s or and they're starting to go on the wane a little bit. You just thought it was going to carry on and on and on. You never thought that another team would be good enough over a long period of time to stop it. So I instantly thought it was going to happen. And then, of course, Kenny resigns, stopped managing the team. Mm. And you still thought it'd be fine because, the Alan Hansons were still there. I know he was coming to the end of his career as well, but there was that much experience around the club that you just thought they'd carry on and win and win and win. So for it to stop and stop for such a long time, if someone said in 89 this would be the last, next year would be the last time you'd win the league, you would have thought they were mad.
Yeah. And had you got a chance, you're obviously very young at that stage, you're still a teenager. Had you tasted the success? Were you around the first, obviously those couple of years are firstly very tragic couple of years for the club, but also very dramatic from the 88 Cup final, the defeat to Wimbledon, winning the 89 Cup final with Hillsborough in between. Are you around the first team for all of that?
Yes, I was, yeah. I was around the first team from the ages of 17. I used to travel with the first team, and back then it'd be one substitute or two substitutions. Mm. So I'd always be like the 16th man, travel with the team, get a lot of experience, not necessarily get changed, but being around them all the time. And
that must have been insane.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was. You just used to sit on whatever you sat on the bus, and after games, Ronnie Moran would come back and say, the ones who didn't play, you're playing the reserves on Wednesday, because it used to be Saturday, Wednesday, the reserves would flip with the first team. So we had an extraordinarily strong reserve side as well. And we won the league with the reserve team. So I was always getting the experience that I needed, but they knew from an early age that, they thought I was going to make it. So I was always thrust into this limelight, and it was always a case of, being with the first team, not getting changed. And then 6 months later, I may get changed. And then 6 months after that, you're on the bench, and then, you go on. That was like the natural progression. So
did you think you were going to make it? if everyone around you at the club is putting you in these scenarios?
I think at 15, 16, you don't necessarily know. You know you're talented. You know you can mix it with your age group. But until you become a man, until you grow up, until you get, you know, hairs under your arms and hairs on your face, you don't know whether you're going to fill up physically. And if anybody sees me, when I was 15, I was absolutely tiny. I could play football, I could dribble, I was good on the ball, but I was tiny. And it was always the case of, will he grow, mm. You know, and I woke up one day like Bambi, as my dad once said, the legs are shot out and I was tall and thin. And then, I was never big physically, as in, you know, muscly, but I was always quite wiry and I could always move my body well. So it was, I caught up with everybody then, and then my talent took me past a lot of them.
Yeah, were you able to almost catch people by surprise because of the skills you had with your height?
Yeah,
you
probably
weren't quite Peter Crouch, good feet for a big man, but like for your traditional tricky winger, Patton Evans style, you're a good half foot bigger.
I was always that way. But, you know, when I always played above my age group. So for the Liverpool schoolboys, I was playing, you know, for the under 15s when I was 13, 14. And you're suddenly playing against other opposition. And, you know, some of them are like men at that age. Some of them who grow early and they've got beards. And I'm playing against them thinking, oh, my Lord. But so they're probably looking at me thinking, oh, we're just going to kick this kid out of the way. You know, he's not going to be any danger. So the fact that you had to adapt your game to deal with this physicality, I think it suited me, to be very honest.
And you used clean John Barnes' boots?
I used to clean Barnes' boots, yeah.
And was that because he was set up to be a role model? Somebody
well,
you could
Well, you know what? I can't remember what happened, whether you were given it. I used to clean Barnes' boots and Bruce Grobbelaar's boots, but I used to be in awe of Barnes' because I just thought he was the most incredible footballer. I mean, he's a gentleman anyway, a lovely man. Treated me really well, as an apprentice. And then to go and, you know, of course, being the same side as him for a number of years and, you know, see him regularly now. But he was a brilliant footballer, so and he taught me all the right things. But to be very honest, all the Liverpool players, because they were so successful and so experienced, they managed themselves away from the game really, really well. And, I always looked up to them, I really did.
And would they have been good with their time? Was there a keen sense of passing it on to the next
very
generation?
Much so, yeah, very much so. They were you were training with them all the time, and they're always, you know, stopping you, you know, showing you where you're going wrong, because of course you're forever going wrong when you're a 16, 17 year old child. So they're trying to help you. They're always giving you words of encouragement. They're telling you, speed up, do this, one touch, do this, or whatever the case may be. And then it's up to you then to listen and learn and then take it into practice. It's all, you know, I work at Liverpool now at the academy, and you know, you're forever telling the younger kids these pearls of wisdom, these words of advice, you have to do this, but it's up to them to go out and implement it on the pitch. And there's only so many times, you know, you can tell them, and some kids will fade away and some kids will take that advice and improve and go forward from there.
And were you cocky at that age when you're breaking into the team?
No, I mean, I was from Liverpool, so I always had a little bit of chat back to them, but I was always very, very respectful of them because they were too good. They were the best of the best at that time, and I wanted to be with them. So I would never try and, you know, be cocky with them or talk back to them or show them I was arrogant. I was always very, very respectful to the first team.
So the obvious question is, where does it all go wrong then?
Where does it all go wrong? I know the answer is, you know, when Graeme Souness came over, we won the FA Cup, and you always just thought that, you know, after winning one, the next one will come. Mm. And then it got to the stage where we knew that the transitional stage from, you know, the 1991 group, to a certain extent, a lot of the experienced players were coming to the end of their careers, and we knew we had we didn't need two players, we needed, you know, five, six, seven players at the time to come in. And whether it's a few bad signings, not necessarily bad signings, but signings that don't fit in with the culture of the club or the nature of the club or the way we play football at Liverpool Football Club, which is paramount, it just becomes further and further away. And then you try and get it back round again. And with Roy Evans, we tried to get it back round again. We won the League Cup and, you know, the FA Cup final, and we were always there or thereabouts. But unless you win, you know, everybody else loses, don't they? So, you know, if you finish second nowadays, people are thrilled because you're in the Champions League. You know, that's finishing fourth, everybody's celebrating. at the end of the game. You know, as far as I'm concerned, that, you know, all that was nonsense. You either won or you lost. And unfortunately, Manchester United at the time just had that little edge over us. And whether it's because they had a couple of better players than we did as a group, or whether they were just stronger mentally somewhere a lot across that group. But, you know, it's like now. Manchester City, you know, won last year and battered everybody, didn't he? And you have to just keep on going and try and take over. And it's just been too long.
During those first few years then, as you're breaking into the team and bit by bit, you're not contending for titles and you're dropping further and further down the league. Are you too young at that stage to fully grasp what's happening, to try and put a stop to this, to say,
yeah,
hey, you're the guy, you have this connection still with even the old boot room, what's handed down through the generations?
I mean, Ronnie Moran and Roy Evans, they were there still sort of second in command, particularly when Graeme Souness was manager, and then, of course, when Evo became manager. But because I was 19, 20, you probably didn't have a grasp of, you know, I wasn't experienced enough or I wasn't senior enough to try and do something about it. I became senior enough, of course, the more I played. But we still had a lot of, you know, big senior players in the group, and you were trying your best, but there was 3, 4, 5 of us who were, you know, in our young 20s or late teens, as in like Robbie Fowler and people. And we were probably too young to and we had too many young players to take the team forward.
Often when we do nights like this, we talk to former Republic of Ireland legends about Euro 88 and Italia 90, and the stories flow pretty easily about the nights out
hijinks.
There seems to be some sort of omerta with that Spice Boys generation which makes me wonder what exactly happened.
No, to be honest, I think the label was, if you can remember, I mean, I was never a big...
What's up on the screen is the picture, obviously, from the 96 Cup final white cream suits.
That had nothing to do with the fact that, you know, people thought it was the Spice Boys. That, whoever the club captain was at the time, just, you know, pick your suits. In 92, somebody picked suits. I just bloody wore them. You know, I was a player.
No stage did you say, maybe this isn't the best idea?
No, because if they're awful suits, aren't they? But at the time, I'll stick by this, they were all right at the time.
Really?
They're not now. But if you see me at games in at any other game in 92, 93, 94, when you've got a blazer on or a jacket, you know, some of them are green, some of them are orange. If you look back 20 years later, you look a fool, of course you do. But at the time, somebody chose them. You know, I didn't have a say in the suits, and you just wore them.
Was it a cup of tea you were walking around sort of nonchalantly with? Live on the BBC.
What's wrong with that? What's wrong with a cup of tea?
Just sort of fed into the whole.
No, there was whiskey in there.
Yeah, we're just chilled out here. It's cup final day.
I was trying to calm my nerves. There was a whiskey and coke in there. No, it was just a cup of tea. Yeah, it was a few hours before the game. You go out and have a look at the pitch and check the check what it was like. But as for the partying, I mean, we of course had a few lads who'd play games and go out and be seen in London after games. I wasn't one of them. I was a Liverpool boy. I stayed out in Liverpool. If I went out in Liverpool. And I think that's where sort of the rumours came from, that, you know, lads would be seen after games. Mm. They'd be jumping on a plane and going down to London to go out and enjoy themselves. And the names of the Spice Boys changed every week. One week it might be me, Robbie Fowler, Redknapp and McAteer. The following week Phil Babb was in it. Next week David James was in it. And then Neil Ruddock could be in it. So it was, to be honest, most of it was a load of nonsense, but
enjoyable.
I mean, I'm from Liverpool. I played for Liverpool. I enjoyed myself. There's no problem about that. Yeah.
Was it then more maybe the reaction of people around Liverpool? Because I guess that's the first time football's becoming pretty cool at that stage.
Yeah, probably.
It's just around the time of Euro '96. There's more and more money coming into the game. There's almost a separation coming between footballers and the ordinary supporter that hadn't really been there before.
Maybe. I think if around about that time, you know, for instance, we had a group of players like the Manchester United group of players who were relatively more or less the same age as us. That's in 96, of course. And they were doing predominantly the same type of things that a lot of our lads were doing, as in going out and enjoying themselves. It's just that they were winning. That's the only thing. If you win, you can get away with most stuff. You can go out and enjoy yourself. But if you go out and enjoy yourself and you lose, people can always hit you with that, with that, and that, you know, that's completely correct. That's exactly what I'd be doing nowadays if you were losing games. If you win games, I'm more than happy. You prepare as you prepare, the way you want, as long as you've come the game, you're fantastic. You can go out and do exactly what you want again. And that's what the Liverpool team, who were very successful in the 80s, did. You know, they all didn't behave like angels. They all prepared exactly how they did to win a game and to win trophies. And some of them might have a drink before the game. You know, I played in Spain, and the night before the game, our lads would have a couple of beers before the game. And in England, that would just be, you know, you'd be shot at for that. You know, people would be appalled.
Well, the culture here and in England is that you probably couldn't be trusted to have just two beers. You'd want to have a few more.
I know. Well, I mean, that is ridiculous if you're a Premier League footballer and you're allowed to have a beer and then you can't be trusted not to have 10. I mean, that just doesn't happen. That can't happen. Night before the game.
Did it happen?
No, it didn't. Because we weren't allowed, that's why. But in Spain, they knew before your dinner, you know, have a few pints or a glass of wine. There's always wine on the table because there was just an element of trust. So it's just how different cultures perceive, you know, how footballers should be.
So you wouldn't feel you were in better shape in Spain than you were at that period with
Liverpool? Absolutely not. People have different ideas about diet. If I had a cup of coffee before my dinner, the Spanish players would go mad. And you're like, you know, you're looking at them, you know, and they're like, you know, the coffee will fill you up, which of course it does. So you're not eating your proper food. So they'd rather you have a beer. They'd rather you have a glass of wine. But, you know, have a coffee and, you know, that's just chaos. Where in England, it's the other way around, isn't it? It's like, yeah, I'll have 10 coffees as long as you don't have a lager. So it's just different. That's all it is. You know, people say the right are there. People say the wrong there. But if you're winning and you're lifting trophies, you can generally do whatever you want.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think Lionel Messi gets told what to do and what to eat? I mean, the manager's scared of him. You know, Cristiano Ronaldo, nobody tells them what to do. They're just left.
I don't think Cristiano's abusing his body, really.
No, I know. But, the big players just get left. The Sergio Ramos, whoever you want to say, they just get left to do whatever they want because they're trusted that they will just prepare themselves in the right way and do the business.
There's obviously a conversation ongoing at the moment about Manchester United and the leadership in their dressing room at the moment and the lack of it. And Keenan Neville very keen to point out last week about the amount of leaders in the United dressing room of that time. Who were the leaders in that Liverpool dressing room around then?
They would have been the experienced ones. They would have been the likes of, you know, early on, if we're talking about early, it would have been the likes of Ian Rush's and the John Barnes. It was still very, very relevant in the dressing room at that age. And then, you know, if we bought any players, they'd still, you know, the bosses would still be, you know, the likes of Barnsley, who was around for a while. He played, a lot for Liverpool in the 90s. So we would have referred to him. We signed Paul Ince later on, and he was very vocal in the dressing room. Neil Ruddock was vocal in the dressing room. But I think the people you looked up to were the people who could do it on the pitch, really. They didn't have to be a shouter or a screamer or they just had to show by example, really, that they were the ones to follow. And it would have been Barnsley.
Did Neil Ruddock not run around with a pound coin handing it to everybody, and whoever ended up with it at the end of the game had to pay for the round that night?
I think that has grown arms and legs, that story. But
is it true?
I think one of them, I don't think it lasted the whole game. I think it lasted about 5 minutes. And I think that did happen. I wasn't there, but I think it did happen in one particular game.
So how did it work?
I think he just handed it to somebody.
So somebody had a pound coin and you'd hand it to your teammate while the game is ongoing?
I'm not entirely sure, but yes, I think that was the gist of it. I don't know whether it was a pound coin. I don't know whether it was 2 pence. I don't know what it was, but something was handed to somebody. But the fact that I think it was Aston Villa away and I wasn't there, so I'd have to refer to somebody who was there. Because I wouldn't, to be honest, I wouldn't have ever taken part in something like that. I think that's just ridiculous.
Was McAteer likely to have been
McAteer
involved?
Was definitely there.
Did you get Robbie Williams onto the team bus to sing?
Not to sing, no. Again, this story's grown arms and legs. Robbie Williams came to support the team, and he came on the team bus to the game, I think. That's what happened, and that's all it was. Back then, of course, people coming on the bus wasn't a huge thing to go the 10 minutes from the hotel to the stadium. But the fact that it was Robbie Williams, and I don't know, again, I don't know whether we won or lost that game, but I think we may have lost that game. So again, it's met with incredulity, the fact that, but he wasn't on the bus singing songs and stuff. That's just absolute bollocks, really. Sounds good, but it's not.
It does sound good, which is
it
the main thing.
It sounds amazing. It sounds amazing. Let's roll with it. Yeah, he was singing songs.
At that stage of your career, and one thing, looking back in your career, the people who worked with you always said, you know, you had a brilliant ability to put your head down when you needed to and work incredibly hard and get the best out of yourself. Around that time, then, the Cup Final, leading into Euro 96, everything that went on the flight back from Asia with Gaza and the dentist's chair.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, are you concerned at that stage about the public's perception of you?
Yes, I was concerned about, not necessarily the dentist chair, because again, that was a private party. I think it may have been Gaz's birthday, and that was just a private party between all of us. The fact
on
that
an airplane.
No. That wasn't the dentist chair.
Yeah,
the dentist chair was in the was in a bar in Hong Kong, and that was just a private party. So I wasn't necessarily bothered with that. I was bothered about the stuff on the plane because it wasn't true. It wasn't about me. And when you pick up a newspaper and there's a huge story about you and about Robbie Fowler, the pair of us wrecking a plane. Now, that did worry me because, of course, I have to then say, well, it bloody wasn't me. You know, it was Paul Gascoigne. But, of course, you couldn't say it at the time.
Throw your teammate under the bus.
So, well, we didn't, did we? But I got, that was the problem. I went down to, we were met up with England for Euro 96 and we have a team meeting instantly. And I'm like, this is not me. And then they come out with this collective responsibility nonsense, which means, I don't even know what it means, but people are then to start looking. I said, well, it's still not me. I'm still telling people, it's not me. Forget the collective responsibility. It's not me, and it's not Robbie Fowler. So, that's why I had to tell people. But once you read it in the front or back pages of a newspaper, regardless of whether it's right or wrong or the story's true or false, it's hard then, isn't it? You know, you can only tell your family, they believe you, but then you feel as if, funny enough, the story was about wrecking a plane. And then that Sunday, I see the story. And then I'm flying down from Manchester to London to meet up with England. So I'm getting on this plane and all these people are looking at me like that, reading the story, like, oh my God, there's going to be carnage. So, and I'm like, it's not me. You know, it wasn't my fault.
It'll be fine.
So, yeah, so it is, you know, that is really hard. It is trying to tell people who you love, this had nothing to do with me. You know, and they're like, oh God, you know, I can't believe it. But unfortunately, it happens. It happens in football.
And when you land down in London and you have your first team meeting after probably two or three of the most controversial days ever in English football, after all the photographs of what happened in Hong Kong, what's that team meeting like? Are you all pretty relaxed because you know what happened, or is there?
Yeah, well, the Hong Kong stuff was fine. It was. Because everybody knew what happened there and then. And, of course, we all knew about that. And it was like a private party. You know, whoever the barman or the barmaid had taken a load of stories and sold them, which, of course, there's nothing you can do about that. But it was just us. It was just us and the team and the local sponsors we had. So, you know, everybody who was in there was managerial. So they knew that nothing untoward went on. It was just that, you know, a laugh and a joke after being away for 10 days. It was the team meeting we had to have then about, you know, the story about the plane and what went on the plane. And we had to come and face it. But there was a huge battle back then between the press and the team, because a lot of the team felt that the press had overstepped the mark on a lot of occasions. So I don't know whether you remember, none of the team spoke to the written press during Euro 96 at all.
Yeah.
They spoke to the cameras, the BBCs, the ITVs, whoever it may be, because you were on camera. But nobody talked to the written press. And it was sort of, I think that whole episode was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. There was a lot went on, a lot of untruths, a lot of stories. And that was the final nail. We just said, right, as a team, we're not speaking to them. And it was disappointing because Euro 96... was an incredible opportunity, you know, to get behind everybody. And in the end, you know, the team were not speaking to them. So that was very unfortunate.
Euro 96 for you must have been just hugely enjoyable. Mm. Like, for people in my generation, to even watch that tournament was such an incredible month for football in this part of the world. And, like, to play so well.
Yeah.
Is that one of your happiest times as a player?
Yes, I mean, it helped because it was in England. You know, you felt special because it was in England. And the first game didn't go great, we drew against Switzerland, but the Scotland game, and I think playing Scotland helped everybody sort of really warm to the tournament. And then it didn't half snowball, you know, and then you'd leave the hotel to go to Wembley. We played every game at Wembley again, which helped. Huge crowd, great atmosphere. And, you know, you'd leave the stadium and people would be outside the houses waving flags and cheering, and, you know, as you drove into Wembley. So it was, you know, I had a great time when I went to France in 98 in the World Cup, or 2000. But when you're sort of home, you know, it is extra special, and it's a pity we haven't had a tournament, you know, since then. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd love to get the World Cup back or whatever the case may be, because the team would benefit, you know, an extra 10%. We benefited the fact that it was here. We benefited, the fact that the crowd was constantly with us. And you saw the crowd last year when the team did well. You know, you were just desperate to be there, weren't you? Desperate to support the team. And you can imagine if it was here. Imagine if it was in England. It'd be something special.
Yeah, could be here at this stadium in Dublin and in England in 2030. The way, who knows? Possibly.
Possibly. You never know.
You go back to Liverpool then. Like, are you getting itchy feet after Euro 96? When does that start?
Itchy feet? No, not necessarily. I didn't know. I was too young to get itchy feet then. I was too much of a home bird. I was too much of a Liverpool lad. I love my mother and father too much. I didn't want to leave them. I didn't want to leave Liverpool. I was too happy there. So no, I wasn't getting itchy feet then in 96, no.
You have a good team as well around 96, 97. You get close.
Yeah. The
two games against Newcastle are probably the two standouts, the 2-4-3s, which are such an integral part of both of them. And both of them then are followed by these
shit results, I know, yeah.
Coventry, Wimbledon.
Well, I think that's the thing. We went from huge occasions like that where you think, yeah, and then where I mentioned before about being mentally, you know, strong, I think that was the thing. You know, you beat a team who were flying high like Newcastle and you play really well. And then you go to one of the teams who was struggling and you perform so, you know, abjectly at times, and you're thinking to yourself, you know what, you know, what's gone, what's there? We should have gone from that Newcastle game, certainly the first one, and when Stan Collymore scored the winner, we should have gone again and again and again. And unfortunately, we couldn't. We sort of went 1-2-3 and then dropped instead of going 1-2-3-4-5 and just keep ploughing on.
Because you would think with the momentum, like that moment, still people think of it as the greatest Premier League game to drop off 3 days later.
And I think that's the one thing that, you know, when people say, why, what happened, that, You honestly don't know, and I always say maybe they had a couple of better players than us. I mean, that's too easy, but I think mentally, you know, we had to be winning those games. We had to be doing it as an 11, as a 12 with our substitutions. We had to be at our best. And maybe, I mean, I can't remember, but maybe at that time we only had 7 at the best instead of the 11, and that was the problem at times.
And you obviously went on and were part of a Madrid side that didn't make those slip-ups, that were able to be consistently relentless. Yeah. So having gone through that experience, like, when you do look back, are you able to put your finger on it? Is it just that the players weren't good enough? Like, is there something you could have done differently?
I wouldn't say the players were not good enough. I'd just say, I can't remember the games. You know, you'd love to go over certain games again, and I'd have a better idea of what the faults were or whether we made big mistakes in certain games. And you can pinpoint it and go, well, that was a mistake by him, that was a mistake by whatever, or that was someone missed a sitter, that could have changed the game, because there probably are reasons like that. But as a whole, you know, when you finish second or third or you just don't get over the line, you analyse it even more. You know, you'd like to think that they had a better team than you, and it's easy. But I remember playing, you know, Man United in the 96 era, 97, and beating them comfortably, and you think, you know, they're not better than us. But over that period of a whole year, you know, they were just somewhere down the line, they were just a little bit stronger than us.
When you look back on your Liverpool career then, do you think you overachieved, underachieved? How do you reflect
on that? I won a couple of cups, which was incredibly enjoyable. You always want to, I'd never say over or underachieve, you always want more, always. And the fact that I'm sitting here now saying 29 years that we haven't won the Premier League, and they last won it in 90, I'd have loved to have won the Premier League. You know, I won the league in Spain, but I would have loved to have won it with Liverpool. you can't win everything, can you? You know, but you can be greedy and want to win everything. So yeah. we played some incredible football when I was there at Liverpool, which I'm very proud of. The ethos never changed with Liverpool. We had to entertain, we had to score. Yes, we conceded, but we always had to score more than the opposition and entertain the crowd. And I always thought we did that. But I would have loved to have won more trophies, definitely.
You were a brilliant big game player as well. Did you feel that during your career? You look back, the 92 Cup final, you're only, what, probably 21. Mm. You're man of the match. You scored 2 goals in the League Cup final in 95. You're man of the match. You're 96, you're brilliant.
Yeah.
You go to Spain, you score in your home debut for Real Madrid. You score in a Champions League final. Was there something about those big occasions?
No. I mean, they were amazing occasions, but no, I didn't feel as if, you know, I could, you know... I just felt you wanted to play well, whether it was against a first round FA Cup game against the lower league side or the final. If you ever got to a final and you were lucky enough to play in a final, you were blessed, really. So you had to give it your all. And, you know, if my all was, you know, playing well and being man of the match, you know, brilliant. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to have done that, you know, on more occasions. I really would have. But, you know, the better, the bigger the game, the better the opposition. I like to think the more I thrive, to be honest.
So what was that 6 months, year like when you were deciding to leave Liverpool and ultimately did decide to go on the Bosman?
It was a strange year, I think, if anybody can think back to that, because it was the year when Roy Evans and Gerard Houllier came in as joint manager, which was a huge mistake. I think we were looking for a new coach, which I think Gerard was going to be, and he came in as joint manager, and our other joint manager didn't know anything about it. So you instantly knew this was going to cause problems. There was a lot of turmoil between who's making the decisions, who's picking the team, who's this, who's that. When we lost, it was Roy Evans' fault. When we won, it was Gerard's. You know, it was Gerard's reasoning why we won. So it was a very strange scenario. Gerard wanted to bring in a lot of his players. Gerard came in. I mean, admittedly, Gerard was great with me. He came in. He said, "Look, I'm a foreign manager, working in a foreign for a foreign club. I totally understand if you want to leave, but if you do, just let me know as soon as possible, just so I can try and find a player to replace you." And I said, "You know, that's fine." I think Evo went, resigned in the November. I'm not entirely sure. Forgive me if I'm wrong. And I decided I wanted to leave. Then I felt Liverpool were changing completely. They were changing, and my mother was really, really ill at the time, and she passed away a couple of months later. So it was a really hard period in my life that way at home, and. Gerard was brilliant. If I ever wanted to miss training to be at home, whatever it was, he'd always let me. Understood completely, but I just felt that I needed to change. I was 27. I'd been at the club since I was 16. It looked as I'd never played in the Champions League at that time, and it looked as if Liverpool were going in a new direction where Gerard was going to bring a lot of his own players in, which was completely fine. And I just thought, you know, this is the opportunity to try something completely different.
So. You had, I think, pretty much every big club in Europe, it seemed, were interested in you. Why Real? What was it that swayed you in the end?
Well, I nearly went to Italy in the December, but Liverpool wanted to keep... Gerard said, "I don't want to sell you now, I want to keep you to the end of the season." So I said, fine. And then, as you said, there was a number of clubs. I don't know. I really like Spanish football. I like the way they played. I like the entertainment value. The Italian league, as we knew, was completely different to the Spanish league at the time. Real Madrid had just won the Champions League in 1998, beating Ajax. They just won the World Club Trophy in 98-99. So they were officially the world's best team, if that makes sense. So to be asked to join them, you know, the white shirts, the Di Stefanos, the Gentos, the Puskases. You know, it was very, very romantic idea. Living in Madrid was completely different to living in a smaller city like Liverpool. And I chose them.
Yeah. Ian Rush obviously had it was like living in a foreign country line when he went to Juventus.
Yeah, he did.
How did you find the actual move then and being able to integrate yourself? Like, were you able to speak Spanish?
Yes, I loved it, to be honest. And funny enough, I was with Michael Owen yesterday, flying to flying to Barcelona, and we were talking about our stays because, of course, he joined. And he lasted a year, and after 5 months, he knew he was desperate to come home. Where it was the other way around with me, and we were talking about the pros and cons. He went over with, a two-year-old baby. He lived in a hotel for 5 months, drove him stir crazy, things like that. Where I went over, and I agreed to join them in the February, whatever it was. And at the end of the season for Liverpool, I went over in private with just my wife. We didn't have any children then, and I went over in private, not telling anybody. And for a couple of days, we just went house hunting. I looked at 30, 40 houses, apartments, and we found somewhere in the dune. So, I signed whatever you had to sign at the time, the contract. So when I went back for pre-season training in July, I went on pre-season tour for 2 weeks, which was difficult because, of course, I didn't know any Spanish then. I'd started taking lessons, but because of the situation in the house with my mum, I said to the teacher not to bother anymore. So I went on pre-season training for 2 weeks, and by the time I come back, my wife and her mother had virtually, decorated the house. The television was in, he had the horse racing on,
everything. Home away from home.
Yeah, so everything was fine. So I sort of came back with my bags and I was in my house.
Yeah.
I don't know whether people know, the type of Spanish lifestyle, but, they eat late, they stay up late, they have siestas. That is me to a T.
It's funny, that seems to have been Gareth Bale's problem, and he spoke about that recently, he can't get used to the fact his teammates want to go out for dinner at 10 o'clock at night.
Exactly, you were going out at midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning after some games, and that suited me, that did. I think the fact that I didn't have any children, whether that helped me, it certainly gave me the freedom to come and go. My wife got a job in the university teaching Spanish lawyers English law. So she was very happy, which is an important thing as well, because, if you're away all the time, and we were away a lot because of the European Games, and your wife is stuck at home on her own or with a small child and can't get out the house, it must be very, very difficult. So the wife was very happy. The team was, I was integrating myself into the team, trying to settle in as much as I can, trying to do, homework, trying to get lessons sorted. So, I found it really enjoyable. I did. I loved, and you got, you were very fortunate, because if the team does well, you got treated like an absolute king in Madrid. You do, and they still do now. In England, I don't know who, or here in Ireland, who the top of the tree are, whether it's film stars, whether it's footballers, whether it's actors, whether it's people on the telly. I have no idea. In England, it's like people look up to the film stars, whatever. Footballers are cool and trendy, but they're sort of, the down here, aren't they? The musicians are far cooler. In Madrid, if you were a football player, you were the,
You're the man.
Yeah. Restaurants stopped, you didn't pay for a beer, you didn't pay for your food. I mean, admittedly, you're leaving massive tips for them, because in the end, you know, I'd go with a restaurant with 10 people and they'd go, right, have you got the bill? No, it's free.
Yeah.
You go, well, I want to come back, but I don't want to come back and get free food all the time. So you'd end up just leaving, massive tips. But their generosity was just exceptional.
The 2000 Champions League final then, we have the goal from the game against Valencia in the Champions League final. Mm. Like, does that just, for you, is that the night where, I made the right decision, everything was
in
perfect?
Yeah, Roberto Carlos.
We watched the goal
headed first. Away as far as McManaman.
Oh. I mean,
a moment
go on, give it up.
Of brilliance from Steve McManaman. And England international.
That's the second goal in the 3-0, and it's pretty tight at that stage. It's 1-0, and you're under a bit of pressure.
I mean, they were a better team. They were a better team than us that particular year, and they were favourites going into it. But we won really comfortably in the end. I don't know whether it was that the fact that Real Madrid have been to Champions League finals before and can handle it better. But it wasn't a case of vindication, because I always, regardless of whether, it was always the right thing to do to broaden my horizons and move at the time. But it was a hard first year for me, as I alluded to. I played my last game of the season at Anfield and sort of got clapped off by everybody and by my teammates. And my mother passed away the following two nights afterwards. It's as if she waited for me to finish my Anfield career. Mm. And then we had a game opening the Stadium of Light, the Sunderland Stadium, about 2 days later, I think it was. And I got a call off my dad saying that, I think she's going to go tonight. So I whizzed home. So that was the last I saw of sort of my teammates at Liverpool, which was very unfortunate. I couldn't really say goodbye to them. And so 6 weeks later, something, I moved to Madrid. So it was hard because me and my father were like that. He loved his football. You know, I was his best mate. So he lost his wife and his sort of eldest son who he followed the football with. So it was a very hard first year for me. My dad would come over a lot and he'd bring his friends over, but you know, he wasn't a great flyer, so he'd go home. So I'd worry about him constantly. But where I celebrate there, they're all there in the crowd in Paris. There's about 19 of them, a load of mates, a load of friends, a load of my dad's friends. So I run over to them there. So it probably meant more to them, you know, to see my father than me to think about it. But to lift the trophy, you know, even now it's considered the best, isn't it? So to do it then. And that was the first year I played in the Champions League as well, and that was another reason I felt that I had to leave Anfield. So to win it was really, really nice.
The Madrid team is just insane when you're at Real. I was looking at some of the matches. So the last Clásico that you started and won was a 2-0 win in 2002. The midfield, McManaman and Figo on the wings, Makalele and Zidane in the middle of midfield, Morientes and Raul up front. And then they add Ronaldo that summer.
Then Ronnie came in, yeah. He was a bit overweight, though, Ronnie, that year.
I think he still scored 30 goals.
I know. I know. I mean, he was, yeah. I mean, the squad was good enough, as you remember. And that was the year we used to just bring sort of one player in every season.
It was
Luis, wasn't it? Yeah, and then it was Zizou, and then it was Ronnie. Yeah, yeah. They all came in a year later just to add to the squad.
What was training like?
Really relaxed, actually, because as I alluded to right at the start of the show, the manager, Vicente del Bosque, was very, very quiet, very quiet. He wasn't a big communicator. Football and the training sessions were incredibly basic. I mean, incredibly basic, you know, two times round the pitch, let's have a game. You know, like things like that where you think to yourself, this is just mad. But again, the players were so good that It was actually quite easy, you know. When we played on a Saturday, it was like, right, you're playing Alaves, you're better than them, you know. I'll see you later, you know. That was about how was it, you know. That was
just looking around the dressing room, he's right.
Well, he's right, yeah. And of course, there's times when we get beat, and if you got beat, you'd be like, right, let's go back, because he knew that the captain would have been like Fernando Hierro at the time. They were the ones that are right, you know. The manager didn't have to say anything. It was the captains. And you looked around into your teammates' eyes and you thought, right, you know, I can't let them down. You can't let them down. So you knew that generally you were going to be good enough to do the business. And that was the thing. He was incredibly late. He trusted everybody. If you don't feel great today, go into the gym or go and have a massage. You know, it wasn't this. Because you were playing twice a week, three times a week, constantly, none of the players were trying to opt out of things just for an easy ride. They were opting out because they were sore or whatever they needed. But it was a case of whatever you need, just get yourselves through. And it was really quite liberating, actually, because it was just that trust of, you know, I trust you. I know how good you are. I know I've got the desire to win. And, you know, I understand that. Do what you need to do to prepare yourselves for the next game.
Look, you're obviously at that level and you're fully worthy of your place in a team like that. Are you still there with Zidane and Figo at times going, bloody hell?
No, because they were actually quite quiet. And when Zizou came, he was an incredible footballer. But he didn't speak Spanish. So he spoke Italian and he spoke French, of course. And he conversed with Claude Makélélé a lot. But he was a very, very quiet man. Kept himself to himself, incredibly professional. And his first year, he actually really struggled his first year for the first 6 or 7 months to settle in, to find a place. Mm. We played him on the left, the right, in the number 10 role behind the forwards of a one. And even the greatest, you know, at the time, certainly, and depending on who you speak to, could have been the greatest ever, struggled to acclimatise and to settle in at certain places. But when he did settle in, he showed how good he was. But you knew how good he was by watching him in training. But even the best, you know, can struggle if they don't learn the language and get on with all the teammates. Yeah. So it was hard for everybody.
So who of the three then, of Ronaldo, Figo, Zidane, who was the best?
Well, I always said Zizou was the best.
Why?
I just thought he was, firstly, an exceptional footballer, that goes without saying. very, very graceful, could do things with a ball that you thought yourself, wow, you know, I can do most things with a footballer, I really can. But when you looked at him, you thought, that's just incredible how he's done that.
And what
Luis was great, sorry. And when Ronnie came, unfortunately, he was an amazing footballer, but he was past his best. And it was sad, really, because he was amazing when he joined us. But he was a little bit weight. He had scars like you've never seen across his knees because he's had that many knee operations, which hindered him. And we had a couple of lads with us who'd played with him at Barcelona, and they said when he was at Barcelona under Bobby Robson, they said he was just the most incredible human being that they'd ever seen, ever. He couldn't get the ball off him ever. He just used to beat the whole team and score. So it could have been Ronnie, but by the time he reached us, he was probably past his best.
Did you ever go partying with him?
Ronnie, yes. Of course, he's Brazilian. Yeah, when we won the league in 2003, I think it was 2003, and Robbie Fowler came over. You might know the story. Robbie Fowler came over one of his first times. He was in Portugal on holiday, and I said, why don't you come to the game? And it was the first time he'd ever come over. So he came over with his brother-in-law, who's a painter and decorator. So they trot over. I give them a couple of tickets. Anyway, we win the league, and then after the game, it's like, right, we're on a bus going round to, we go down to like a fountain called Thibelis, where they travel, you know, they party round. So I said to the growler, come on, come with me. So we went, no. I said, yeah, here's a T-shirt, which had like league winners on, you know, whatever, white T-shirt. So we stuck that on, and he gets on the bus with all of us, you know, jumping round and celebrating. So as we're going round, I'm like, come and get on, you know, come round the fountain with us, you know. And he says, no, I'll stay here. Anyway, there's all people in the crowd, they're all going, there's only one Robbie Fowler. So there's a load of English people there. So we finished that, you know, hundreds of thousands on the streets. And then we go to a restaurant, talk about eating late. So we sit down to this restaurant about 2 a.m, whatever. Eat our food, celebrate any meal. There's loads of us there, my wife, all friends and everybody. Everybody's the same. 5 a.m, right, let's go to a nightclub. So we go to a nightclub, carry on partying. Robbie is painted and decorated cousin. All of us, right. And I had like a driver who used to drive me around. He came in, it was a Sunday night, Monday morning. He comes into the nightclub and he hands me my keys and he goes, I have to go. And I said, what's wrong? He said, I have to go to work. I said, what time is it? He said, it's 9 a.m. So we leave at 9 o'clock. What do? Round to Ronaldo's house. So the party goes round to his. So we're in this like party room. There's me, Robbie, painter and decorator. Ronaldo playing pool. He's got a smoke machine on, puts the smoke machine on, bit of music, all dancing round. There's chaos. His body's lying all around the house, drunk. And we're just, Robbie's just sitting there going, I just can't believe this. So you can imagine what the painter and decorator was like. And playing Ronaldo for pool. So, yeah. So it was... The Brazilians know how to enjoy themselves, don't they? I think the fact that a lot of them were born with, you know, relatively nothing, as we know a lot of the stories about them. Whatever they get, you know, they spend with people and enjoy themselves. And Ronnie, Roberto Carlos, they were big in the entertainment value. So it was we had a really good group of lads then. You know, different nationalities who enjoyed themselves in different ways, but we all just clicked and all really got on.
Yeah, Steve, you've been brilliant with your time. You're going to stick with us because we have a lot more to go. Yeah, we need to take a quick ad break, though. We are here with thanks to Boyle Sports. You can download the Faster Than Ever Boyle Sports app for exclusive price enhancements, bet builders and cash out on the Premier League and Champions League. We're here live at the Aviva Stadium this evening. We're talking all about Liverpool. We're going to chat about their Champions League and Premier League title hopes. You can get in touch, hashtag Aviva, if you're watching online, or text us here on News Talk on 53106. We'll take a quick break.
Football on Off The Ball.
Brought to you by Boyle Sports. Now with same-day withdrawals to your Visa debit card.